You're listening to Non-Zero World. I'm Andrew Day.
And I'm Connor Eccles.
Each week, we break down the latest developments in U.S. foreign policy and other global news. And we interview a leading expert or activist. To gain access to full-length episodes and other exclusive content, become an NZN member today at Robert Wright's Non-Zero newsletter on Substack. So Connor, in this week's issue of The Earthling, which is the weekend edition of the Non-Zero newsletter, which we co-author along with Bob, Robert Wright, our meatiest and most topical item is definitely the one about the situation in Syria. Earlier today, you and I interviewed Bassam Barabandi, who was previously a Syrian diplomat, but who has defected, I guess you could say, from the Assad regime, and now he's hoping for a peaceful post-Assad future for his country. We're going to play that interview after our news roundup. And the first news story we wanted to start with is indeed the one about the dramatic turn of events in Syria. So, Connor, what's been going on there this past week?
Yeah, so like you said, Andrew, there has been a really remarkable turn of events in Syria this past week. After about 4 years of a more or less completely frozen civil war, a pair of opposition groups, one a controversial Islamist group and the other a loose coalition of militias affiliated with Turkey, mounted this really rapid offensive that in a matter of days has managed to take several of Syria's largest cities in a row, and now appears potentially like it could lead to the actual fall of Bashar al-Assad's regime. You know, most notably, you know, as we're talking right now, Friday morning, rebel groups are approaching Homs, which would be the third major city that they would capture, and would be this major strategic point that kind of connects the southern part of Syria with its Mediterranean coast. If they take that, the theory is that that's pretty much it for the regime. You know, all of this has really highlighted the extent to which the balance of power in the Middle East has shifted over the past year due to this conflict that we've seen between various members of the so-called Axis of Resistance and Israel on the other side, as well as the U.S. to a lesser extent. You know, at this point, Iran has made fairly clear that it is not going to seriously step in to try to change what's happening on the ground in Syria. Russia has made extremely clear, Russia being another major ally of Assad's that has been, you know, very distracted by its war in Ukraine, has also made clear that it won't be stepping in to really help as it did back in 2015. So what we're seeing is, you know, all of a sudden there may be a genuine fall of the Assad regime, or at least a very dramatic change to the composition on the ground. You know, this presents a lot of thorny questions for the future of Syria, depending on the pace of events. We don't know how Trump will respond to this once he's in office. We don't know if this group that is this controversial Islamist militia, if they'll be able to moderate, as they have claimed, you know, and distance themselves more completely from their past associations with groups that the U.S. considers to be terrorists, like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And so all of those concerns are really in the air. You know, they've taken steps to try to calm that. But as you can see, it's a complicated situation. So we're going to kind of leave more discussion of this to the interview later. But hopefully that will be able to kind of shed more light on this very rapidly developing thing. So with that, I'll probably send it right back to you, Andrew, for our next news bite.
Yeah, and I guess first I want to say about Syria, I mean, the situation is so complicated, as you mentioned, that I think some people might be kind of tempted to tune it out in the West because they just feel like they're not going to be able to understand it. There's all these crisscrossing battle lines and all these different regional actors are and global actors are, you know, are involved. But it's like really important. You know, this situation is really important for thinking about geopolitics. It's kind of like a nesting doll of conflicts, like it's a civil war inside a regional war, inside this global superpower power competition, you know, between Russia and the U.S. So like you, I hope this week's Earthling in our interview shed light on the conflict. And I definitely think they will. This guy we interviewed was really interesting and insightful. Our next story is on President Joe Biden's unusually sweeping, expansive pardon of his son, Hunter Biden. And this story does indeed relate to U.S. foreign policy somewhat, as I'll explain shortly. It also relates to political tribalism, which is a subject of broad interest to this podcast. So until the pardon, Hunter Biden had been awaiting sentencing in two separate cases. He had pleaded guilty to charges related to not paying taxes, and he had been found guilty by a jury of his peers on charges related to the illegal purchase of a gun. But everyone quickly noticed that the pardon doesn't just cover those crimes. It is backdated all the way to January 1st, 2014, and it covers any and all crimes that may have occurred from then until December 1st of this year, which led many to suspect that one of the president's motivations was to preempt Republican-led investigations into Hunter Biden's ties to Burisma, a Ukrainian energy firm. Hunter Biden had served on the board of Burisma starting in 2014, when Joe Biden was vice president. Some people, including Donald Trump, have said that then Vice President Biden acted to shield Burisma from government oversight by kind of strong-arming the Ukrainian government into firing the country's top prosecutor. Another reason this pardon has been controversial is that President Biden had categorically ruled out issuing this pardon. And during the presidential campaign, many in the media had used that promise as evidence that the Democrats care more about the rule of law than Trump does. But this week, Biden explained that he had come to believe that, as he put it, raw politics has infected the justice system, in his son's cases at least, and that his opponents in Congress had instigated the charges. So the intensely tribal character of American politics is at play here. You know, it does seem to have infected the justice system, which is supposed to be neutral and in some cases, in some sense, I mean, apolitical, though obviously, you know, opinions differ on which side, red or blue, did the most to cause the infection. And just to wrap up, I'll note that on the Non-Zero podcast episode that aired on Wednesday, Bob and psychologist Paul Bloom debated the pardon. Paul Bloom defended it. Bob criticized it. And I'll also note that this week's Earthling includes a poll so that our readers can weigh in on the issue. The poll asks whether the pardon was justified, unjustified, or something in between.
And so for our next item, I'm going to talk a little bit about I'm going to stay on the topic of Trump, and I'm going to talk about his nominee for Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth. So we've covered him previously here on Non-Zero, but as some of you may know, he's facing increasing pressure to withdraw his name from consideration for that position amid a series of varyingly lurid allegations related to potential sexual misconduct and even sexual assault, as well as alcohol abuse and Islamophobic comments while intoxicated at company events, including an attempted chant of kill all Muslims that he made and that was reported by several members of the staff of a nonprofit that he had previously worked for. Of course, Hegseth has said that he will, quote, never back down, end quote, in the face of all of this pressure. And he is trying to back up that promise with a series of meetings on Capitol Hill this week. He met with some prominent senators who have expressed reservations about his nomination, but it remains unclear whether he was persuasive in those conversations. And also unclear is whether Trump intends to back up his candidate, as there are now reports that Trump is considering either replacing him with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis or Iowa Senator Joni Ernst, both of whom come from a more hawkish wing of the Republican Party. So you would expect them to sort of be in line with a lot of the early Trump picks who favor a more muscular U.S. foreign policy abroad. And, you know, military force where necessary, as well as strong competition with China, among other things. Advocates of foreign policy restraint are hoping that if Hegseth is removed, that he'll be replaced with Elbridge Colby, who was also a member of the first Trump administration, though his name has not been mentioned very much as being under consideration. So it's unclear if that will happen. I'll briefly mention, too, that Trump announced his pick for the number two job at the Pentagon, which he plans to give to Steven Feinberg, who is a billionaire founder of a private equity firm called Cerberus Capital Management. That nomination will be less controversial in many ways than Hegseth's, as Feinberg has far fewer personal issues that have come to light. But he does have a number of professional ones that have good government advocates worried, including prior investments in defense firms and the fact that Cerberus, this organization that he's run, owns a group, an organization called Tier One Group, that infamously trained several members of the Saudi team that killed journalist Jamal Khashoggi in 2018. Of course, they deny that that training had anything to do with that, but those ties are sure to face scrutiny in Feinberg's hearing.
Interesting. So our next news item is about the Russia-Ukraine war. Russia captured more Ukrainian territory in November than in any other month since September 2022. That's when Ukraine mounted a highly successful counteroffensive to roll back Russian advances and recapture lost territory. And we note in the Earthling that the New York Times had reported in November 2022 that Mark Milley, who, remember, was at the time the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and thus America's top military officer, Milley had been arguing in White House discussions that the U.S. should push for peace talks to kind of lock in Ukrainian gains, if possible. His thinking was that things were not going to get any better for Ukraine, and so they should sue for peace ASAP. While others in the administration, including Secretary of State Antony Blinken, said that Ukraine had the momentum and should keep pushing for more territory. And Bob would consider me remiss if I didn't also mention that he authored a piece in the Washington Post around that time, making essentially the same argument as Milley did. And things obviously look very different now for Ukraine than they did in the autumn of 2022. Ukraine is very much on the back foot. Its forces are demoralized. And as I mentioned, last month was the worst one in quite a long time in terms of territorial losses. And we'll have a bar graph in the Earthling that illustrates that. Though I'll say there hasn't been like a huge breakthrough. Like Russia didn't overwhelm Ukrainian lines in the east, and it's not like marching toward Kyiv. But they are accelerating the pace at which they're taking territory. In a few minutes, we're going to have a more in-depth discussion of the Ukraine war, maybe get into an article I wrote recently called Donald Trump is Ukraine's Best Hope for Peace, in which I argue that Trump will be well positioned to resolve the conflict. But for now, I'll kick it over to you, Connor.
Yeah, sure. So I'm excited for more of that discussion soon. But first, I wanted to talk a little bit about the chip war between the U.S. and China that has been kind of this broader tech war that has been, going on for probably about 6 years now, maybe since the initial restrictions that Donald Trump placed on Huawei, but that has escalated under the Biden administration. Just this week, we saw an raft of new export restrictions issued by the Biden team that are aimed at slowing China's development of powerful microchips and that will restrict Chinese companies' access to various materials necessary for that and, importantly, chip-making equipment. And then in response, the next day, China announced that it would ban exports to the U.S. of a number of kind of crucial materials for various important technology manufacturing, including gallium and germanium, two metals that are needed in the production of semiconductors, and both of which China sort of dominates their supply chain. So all of that provides a little bit of an update to an argument that we mentioned in this week's newsletter from Scott Kennedy of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Kennedy argues in a piece for Foreign Affairs this week that the chip war policy has actually backfired and caused the U.S. to accelerate China's progress in various technological areas. So while he acknowledges that the chip war has helped to at least slow China's progress on AI, he argues that the investment spurred by this kind of growing tensions between the U.S. and China have led Beijing to jump ahead in various technologies that are going to be extremely crucial for the future, especially amid the climate transition. You know, different green technologies in particular, including batteries, electric vehicles, and many of the materials that are necessary to produce those. So Kennedy warns that any further efforts at decoupling, which we can expect in the Trump administration, could further exacerbate this trend of accelerating certain aspects of Chinese economic growth, even while they may restrict some of the things that we're targeting. So I found that to be an interesting story, but I'll throw it back to you, Andrew.
Yeah, so the last item I want to talk about before we move back to Russia-Ukraine is about Iran, and specifically whether U.S.-Iran relations could improve under a Trump administration. And this week brought what I consider the clearest sign yet that Iran's new reformist president, Masoud Pezeshkian, genuinely does want to pursue constructive engagement and better relations with the United States. That's the foreign policy program that he campaigned on. That's what he thinks is the best path for getting these sanctions removed and kind of incorporating Iran back into the part of the international community that's hostile to it. And that's what he seems to be laying the groundwork for. Also, this week, you know, Iran's vice president for strategic affairs published a piece in Foreign Affairs in which he said, quote, "Iran is willing to have a dialogue that would benefit both Tehran and Washington," end quote. So he was quite clear and forthright that, you know, this new president and his administration are ready to talk to Trump, basically. I'll note that the article also said that Tehran's continued diplomatic openness would be contingent on Donald Trump pursuing positive sum solutions to problems in the U.S.-Iran relationship, meaning win-win solutions. And in this week's Earthling, we also linked to a piece that appeared in Responsible Statecraft, in which the author, Mohammad Sahimi, argued that Trump can improve relations with Iran if he doesn't revive this maximum pressure policy of his first term that was intended to elicit concessions from Iran by slapping a bunch of sanctions on them. Sahimi says that Trump should instead basically be ready and willing to pursue constructive engagement right out of the gate, because Iran is ready to negotiate now, according to Sahimi. And Iran might even be, you know, prepared to negotiate a new nuclear deal that would put restrictions on its nuclear energy program. Conversely, Sahimi thinks that if Trump tries to revive, like, tries to do it at maximum pressure 2.0, then a lot of people in Iran are just going to give up on, you know, cooperating with the United States. A lot of the hardliners, you know, all of the hardliners in Iran already don't want to do that. And pretty soon some of the, like, centrists and other conservatives, maybe even the moderates, would also kind of give up on the U.S., as I said. So, Connor, as we mentioned, we're going to have now an in-depth discussion on Russia-Ukraine, or at least more in-depth than this kind of rapid fire we've been doing. And I mentioned earlier that I wrote a piece in which I gave the optimistic case for why Trump may actually succeed in resolving the conflict. You know, Trump has staked his reputation on the promise to do so. So his ego is kind of engaged on this issue in a way that's good, at least for now. He's also shown signs that he understands kind of which buttons to push and which pressures to apply to both Zelensky and Putin to get them to agree to sit down and talk. But it kind of occurred to me when I was talking about Iran just now that maybe I'm a bit too optimistic. Maybe it's like a character flaw, because I've also made the case that Trump is well positioned to get some sort of rapprochement with Iran. So I don't want to be, you know, unduly optimistic. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on, like, the prospects for peace between Russia and Ukraine in the next year or two under Trump.
Yeah, well, I guess well positioned is different than saying that he is going to do it, right?
Right.
You know, I think when you look at the resources that Trump has, like, I think in the case of Ukraine, there's a lot of evidence that kind of something needed to change on the U.S. end, that there had been sort of a zombie policy that wasn't necessarily that's clearly not helping Ukraine to protect its land right now. It lost more land this week than it did again in any week in the past 2 years, which is a startling stat, or not this week, this past month. And we're, you know, kind of seeing a war of attrition set in that most military analysts argue favors Russia on the battlefield. So sort of the entry of a new player into the game will almost inevitably shake that up. There's a few challenges that Trump will face are, you know, that one, now Russia, I think, is feeling its oats, right? Russia sees itself much more so than 2 years ago as in the driver's seat of this conflict, as the one who is able to kind of hold out for the more extreme versions of its goals. I think that they would probably be more willing to participate in negotiations with the Trump administration. I think that we have seen indications of that, but there will be challenges as well. And another kind of important challenge will be that, I'm not expecting U.S.-China relations to improve greatly under Trump. I think, you know, he's said that he's going to slap all kinds of new tariffs, including additional tariffs on China, not just the same tariffs as other countries that he's talked about. I think we can expect more trade war dynamics, and that will make it more challenging for the U.S. and China to potentially cooperate on bringing Russia and Ukraine to the table, because China is, you know, as the other great power and as a close partner of Russia's in the world, is the only other country that may be capable of convincing Russia to kind of make these concessions that it might not otherwise like to. It's able to push different buttons than we are. So I think that that's going to be an interesting challenge and would be a good early test of like U.S.-China relations too.
Yeah. Earlier you said that Russia is feeling its oats, and I totally agree. Like on the battlefield, they definitely have the advantage. It's a war of attrition, and they have a much, you know, larger pool of men who can fight in the war. But I'll note that there's maybe a couple things going on that could be, maybe a few things, several perhaps, that could incline Putin to want to wrap this up ASAP. For one, their economy shows some signs of slowing down. I mean, it is slowing down. And at the same time, they have an inflation problem. So they've had to raise interest rates to be really high. And that's kind of a bad combo. You know, they could be heading toward a stagflation scenario, which is going to be difficult to get out of. And it seems like sanctions are relevant to this slowdown and inflation. And people think that even raising interest rates is not going to get inflation under control, because some of the problems come from sanctions and just a reduced supply of goods. So, you know, that could be interesting, but that would require Trump's team to be willing to lift sanctions on Russia in exchange for Russia agreeing to some sort of settlement. But that's potential leverage that is becoming stronger, I think. Another thing worth mentioning is that Russia's made all these military gains, territorial gains, as we mentioned on the battlefield, but they've come at a tremendous cost, because, you know, Russia's gaining more territory than they have since the early stages of the war. But they've also lost more men than they have since the early stages of the war. Right now, it seems like, you know, they have fewer recruiting problems than Ukraine. They're able to pay like really high salaries by the standards of like rural Russia. So that makes it attractive to some people in Russia to join the military. But they've got like 10,000 North Korean troops helping them in Kursk. But I think, you know, at some point, Putin, looking ahead, might say, well, I really don't want to order a mobilization that has too many political risks. So I think Putin, if the right buttons are pressed, you know, I think he could be persuaded to sit down to talks. And then it's just kind of, you know, the other piece of the puzzle, obviously, is Ukraine. And similarly, I think that they, because of how many men they've lost and because of how much damage this war is doing to their society, surely they'll be willing to countenance peace negotiations. There's a Wall Street Journal report this week that said that Ukrainian officials have been meeting with members of the Trump team. I think Keith Kellogg, the recently appointed envoy for Russia-Ukraine, but also Mike Waltz, the incoming national security advisor, and I think J.D. Vance also joined the call. And so that suggests that they're kind of, you know, wanting to start talking about this specific thing with the Trump team. But I'll note that they're still kind of driving a hard bargain. Like they're kind of warming up to ceding territory, but only in a de facto sense. They say they'll still formally own all the territory that they've lost, and they'll just try to get it back diplomatically. But they're also saying they won't even do that de facto, you know, giving away territory. And if they are able to join NATO, which I think is going to be a non-starter. So hopefully that's just, I say hopefully because I don't think that's going to happen. Even if the U.S. wanted them in NATO, which I don't think U.S. does. I don't think Trump does. He's a big NATO skeptic. J.D. Vance definitely doesn't. You know, but even if they did, like Germany and some other NATO countries don't want Ukraine to join. So hopefully the issue of its security guarantees can be attended to in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense in which now that the possibility of peace talks seems real, and real in a way that it hasn't in a very long time, right? I think both sides are taking steps to sort of establish a hardline negotiating position from which to work. The kind of theory of the case there makes a lot of sense. If you see negotiations on the horizon, don't negotiate with yourself, right? Don't say that, oh, we'll just take EU because like EU membership rather than NATO membership, because then there's nothing to negotiate down from. So I think that we're going to see like a lot of signals from Ukraine and Russia that could be many different things, right? That could seem like hardening of their positions, but are in reality preparation for negotiations, or they could be something else. But there's a lot of ambiguity now. We're kind of entering a very unusual phase of this conflict, but it could be the beginning of the end, depending on if they're willing to sit down and put aside what have been some really challenging problems, because there's thorny problems left too. You know, Putin is wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. Putin is not going to be very excited about that, right? There are many cases against Russia that are going to add some complexity to the resolution of all of this. And so that'll be another interesting aspect to follow. And even, you know, in the past, Zelensky had ruled out and even outlawed, I think in the equivalent of an executive order, but still outlawed any communication with Putin. So that's obviously something that would have to change for negotiations. But yeah, I don't know. This is a kind of, it does feel like there's change in the air.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, at least everyone is talking about peace talks as something that they want to happen. I mean, another thing that, when I say everyone, I mean like the incoming administration, they don't have like the same perspective on this as the Biden administration. And speaking of which, you know, one other thing that happened is the White House has been pushing Ukraine to lower their conscription age. I think it's been 25 this past year. Like that's the youngest Ukrainian that they'll conscript to join the army and fight. But the White House is pushing them apparently to lower that to 18. So we'll have teenagers fighting. And Blinken recently was talking about how, I don't know the context exactly, but there's a video of it you can find on Twitter. But he's talking about how, you know, the U.S. is prepared to give weapons to Ukraine, but those weapons really need men to fight, and that's going to require Ukraine to make some difficult mobilization issues. And what he's kind of obliquely referring to there is that the U.S. wants 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds to be conscripted. It's worth noting that Zelensky has really resisted this. Like his government does not want to mobilize that younger generation because Ukraine, honestly, it was experiencing a demographic problem before the war started, but that's dramatically worsened since the war started. So they want to retain this younger generation of men so that they can kind of rebirth Ukrainian society after the war. So that's something worth keeping an eye on. Unless you have something else to say on Russia-Ukraine, maybe we can again introduce our guest and go to the interview. Did you want to say something else?
Let's get headed to our interview, which, just to remind everyone, is with Bassam Barabandi. He was a diplomat for Syria from the late 90s until 2013, when he defected, and he has since supported the revolution, or kind of the opposition to the regime, after having been a member of it. I think it's a really great interview, so I hope that you do stick around to listen. But if you want to kind of find his analysis more generally, you know, he is on Twitter at Bassam VA, and that is BASSAMVA.
Yeah, and maybe we can also take this time to thank people for listening and for watching, depending on how you're consuming this first episode of Non-Zero World. Please subscribe. to the Non-Zero Podcast on YouTube, you know, smash the like button, rate and review on podcast apps. That all really helps a lot to kind of boost this content in terms of the algorithm. The algorithm that's suppressing us constantly. So that will be very much appreciated. But yeah, let's go now to the interview. So Bassam, thank you so much for joining us. As Connor and I just mentioned, we will have already introduced you in the episode and described your background and told people how to find your account on X. Sure. So now I'll just jump into the questions about the conflict in Syria. And one of the features of this conflict that many people find a little bewildering is that there is a wide variety of players involved, including different rebel groups who are opposed to Assad, but who don't necessarily like each other. And of course, there are also militants involved who would like to bolster Assad's regime. So I was hoping we could begin with you walking us through these different militant groups. You know, what are their ideologies, goals, geopolitical relationships? And when you're talking about HTS, which is the main rebel group that has been leading this lightning offensive, can you say a bit about its historical connections to Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra Front and its kind of recent rebranding away from that?
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. Look, this is a group. Let's start from the beginning, from the roots, so we understand where we are now. So we have revolution 2011. The people went to the street. They asked for basic needs, human rights, transparency, because the system's corrupted, rule of laws, this kind of basic stuff. The regime refused to accept this and start bombing the people. The people get armed, defend themselves. The regime failed. He get the Iranian to support him. Iranian, they have too many ambitions. They need to empire, Persian empire. They want to reach to Israeli border, Mediterranean, taking Iraq and Syria. So they found this great opportunity for them to be in Syria. The other sides who hate Iran, they start to tell the Syrian people, guys, you need to defend yourself. This is the money. This is the weapons. Go and fight Assad. So Syria, little by little, it become a proxy wars between the regional countries. Plus, there's really need for change. The people in Syria, they were asking for the change. And they were fighting, defending their rights. At least that was valid till 2015. 2015, the Iranian failed. So they asked the Russian to come, to join. So they told the Russian, don't send your forces. Our forces on the ground. We need your air force. You destroy the Syrian. We take over. And that's so simple, so easy, so cheap. So the Russian evolved in that sense. That allowed to have more than, let's say, more than 1 million IDPs on the borders, internally displaced people. They extended the border. More than 8 to 9 million refugees, they left Syria. The refugees was played by both Iranian and Russian. So Russian used the refugees to push Europe to be more right-wings. So all the right-wings, political ranks in Europe, the main item in their agenda is the refugees. We don't need more refugees, which is right. They're correct. They've stopped their countries. But that where they come, the refugees from Syria, who brought them? The Russian airlines, the Russian forces. That's the connection from what? On the other hand, the Iranian, they are not accepted by Syrian people. They are different sect, different everything from us, different language, different religion, if you can say. So for them, displacing Syria make them easier for them to control it. So that we are talking from 2015 till 2011, till today, almost till today. During that process, we had many political dynamics. The American interfered. Unfortunately, the American and the Iranian, they reached to the nuclear deal 2015, 2016 at that time, and the cost was Syria. So the American administration, Trump, Obama, and Biden, till today, they think dealing with the nuclear issue of Iran, it's worth it to sacrifice some parts geographically. And Syria was that part. So that will lead us to the Syrian groups, military groups. So the people there, they say, guys, everybody against us. We need someone to support us. We need some Turkey, Qatar, Saudi, Emiratis, American, everybody who's anti-Iran or anti-Russia, find this opportunity to weaken both these countries under the umbrella of supporting Syria. But each one put his own condition. So the Islamist who comes from Qatar or Turkey, they say you should be Islamist. We cannot support people non-Islamist. And the people from the United States, they say you should be secular because we cannot support. I mean, the same people, you know, same pool of people. So the people change their attitude toward the funders because if they think if we don't defend ourselves, we will be killed. So no matter who will give us the money, the support, we will be with them. Little by little, these people move from being revolutionary, freedom fighter, if you call, to be employees, to be people who work under that cult military umbrella that gets support from someone. So the donors start to say, don't fight today, you know, don't fight after tomorrow. Stop here or go fight tomorrow. It's not anymore Syrian cause. Syrian become 100% proxy for other regions. One of the players was Al-Qaeda. They came from Iraq after ISIS, after the Iranian allowed ISIS to take over Mosul. Mosul, they take a lot of Iraqi weapons. They came to Syria. They came to Syria with a lot of money. They had a lot of weapons. And people were suffering from the regime. So this, and you know, this ingredients working well. Poor, poverty, uneducated people under pressure were killed by Russian and by Iranian. And somebody comes and say, you know what? This is the weapons. Why don't you defend yourself? Come join us. We will defend you. That Al-Qaeda, that was ISIS. ISIS defeated, still their babies still available here and there. That's what we have today. So we have HTS, which is different, derivative from Al-Qaeda. And HTS with their Golani, they say, guys, look, I'm Syrian, the Syrian land, I'm Qaeda. I have Salafi ideas. I cannot say I'm terrorist or I'm extremist, but I'm Muslim, strong Muslim believer, and we have to fight for Islam and so on. But I'm not the, like this Qaeda that have cross-border agenda. I have Syrian agenda. Within Syria, we have to make this change. He have the money. He get again support from outside. He recruit a lot of people till we reach today. So they are the largest group, money-wise, organization-wise. There's so many other small groups. We call them secular, semi-Turkish, semi-Syrian. It depends on the funders, unfortunately. Mm. But we cannot ignore the fact that they are Syrian. We cannot ignore the fact that they are really under, yeah, we suffered a lot from Assad, from Iran, from Russia. So there is need, feeling of revenge from Iran, from the Assad. The kind of destruction that happened in Syria, the kind of violation, all kinds of human rights, unbelievable. And yesterday, they released a person from one of the Assad jail. He was jailed in 1985 for no reason. And he was just released yesterday. And that guy, he was really isolated from the world. He still believes that the world still in the history or time of 1982. Yeah. They released a girl. She's 14 years old yesterday. And she was in jail when she was 7 years old. When I talk about the jail, we are talking about small room, under the ground, no sun, no food, raped, and you can imagine a lot of things. So this kind of daily suffering, this kind of this. So today we reach where we have largest group, it's called HTS. Their leaders, 100% affiliated historically, at least 5 years, 4 years ago from ISIS, Al-Qaeda. I mean, this is their own say. We are not claiming. They have a lot of people under them. Are we saying the people under them are like them? It will not be fair. Are they Muslims? They are Muslim for sure. Are they Islamists? We have to wait to see. So this is where we are now.
Yeah, I'm curious, you know, how do these groups, I guess, these different rebel groups relate to each other? Because we're seeing some sort of extraordinary successes. You know, it seems as if, you know, Aleppo fell, Hama fell to the rebels, and it seems as if, as we're recording this here on Friday morning, December 6th, it seems like Homs may fall soon. You know, these rapid advances might be able to cover up some divisions between these groups, but could you speak a little bit to the relationship maybe between HTS and the Syrian National Army, as well as the Kurds?
Let's back a little bit. It's October 6th that they changed everything. When the Hamas act against Israelis, that changed the whole Middle East till today. And still Middle East is changing. So Hamas did terrorist act. They killed a lot of civilian of Israelis. It's out of the war, like army war as usual. And we know the rest. So the Israeli make decision openly, Netanyahu, all the Israeli senior leader, to say there no more October 7th, no more. That means we will take all the precaution to protect our borders, our safety, our security. not from Hamas, from all our neighbors everywhere. And we saw what happens in Hamas. We saw what happens in Hezbollah. Hezbollah was the turning point when Hezbollah was killed, the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah. So just imagine that the Lebanese people who are living in Idlib, they see their leaders who was killed 14 floors underground, all their mid-career officers by Bajor, they were killed, injured 3,000. Iranian officers were killed. So these people, the Iranian people or pro-Iranian people in Syria, they lost all the incentive to fight. They are not anymore winning. They are no morals, no money, no future, no hope, no leadership, no shame, no comments. That from one. The second, this is very important part. And that's why the second part, Israeli was serious in saying no more, never again, let's put it, October 7th. The major part was Iranian, pro-Iranian militia in Syria. Turkey, they hope to expand their vision in Syria. They expand their influence in Syria. I think this is where historical moment match between Israeli need to get rid of Iranian forces in Syria and Turkish want to expand in Syria. That historical moment, maybe it happens once every 200-300 years. Turkey was able to get all these fighters, all these groups with different ideology, different identities, you name it, everything, they unite them. And it happens what it happens. So we have, from one hand, the Turkish, pro-Turkish group, or HTS, and other National Syrian Army and others, they get together under Turkish control, that they put them checklist to avoid mistakes, don't attack, don't kill, be away from minorities, be away from the churches, be away from the gangs, make the pictures, friendly pictures, when we are doing. The other side, the regime and pro-Iranian, they have no incentive to fight, zero incentive. They don't have chain of commands. They don't have an order. They don't have fuel. They don't have reason to fight. Why to kill? Why to be killed? For us, for Assad to survive, that's not the right equation. That's why we see that literally till today, there's no fight. What we are seeing, HTS, other Syrian groups are moving. Other group is leaving. That's it. But there's not fight. We don't have fight till today. From last week till today, the people really were able to liberate three cities almost. We talk about around 5 million inhabitants in this city. The number of casualties, the maximum when people exaggerate, they say 500 concerning that big two cities. I mean, if you go to Aleppo for tour, you need 3 days. They liberate it in 1 day, just to give you something. So this is the real context. This is what's happening. This is why it's happening. This is why Russia didn't interfere. This is, we don't see any international reaction on Syria, not positive, not negative. People are keep silent. Because the real target, number one target, is to get rid of Iranian influence military in Syria. This is number one target. It's Israeli interest. It's Syrian interest to say it 100%. It's our Syrian interest to kick Iranian out. So it's mix of all overlap interest. Now, the second phase, the first phase that we are seeing, that Iran should be out, Assad will be out, this first phase, beauty, lovely, we are happy, Syrian are happy. The second phase will be the dangerous. Are Syrian will accept Islamists to be ruler in Syria? I doubt it. Will these groups that we are talking about, small armies, small groups with HTS, they can survive day after? I doubt it. Will Turkey be able to control all these groups? Because this area is a huge area. Syria is a huge, not small. Bigger question. So the second step of kicking Iranian out, I think still not clear. There's a lot of questions and answer questions.
Yeah, I want to drill it down a little bit on what you just said, because obviously these rebel groups led by HTS have had really stunning military successes this past week or 10 days. And I'm wondering, you know, what are the odds in your view that they'll actually succeed in toppling Assad? And then if so, if they do manage to do that, how capable is HTS, for example, of actually constituting like a national government and, you know, providing services and taking taxes and all of that stuff? And then also, what do you think the chances are that these rebel groups, after Assad falls, if he indeed does, will turn against each other and there will be another kind of bloody phase of a civil war?
Look, historically, we don't know the future. So we talk about the history. So future, we don't know it. We have the model of Taliban when they went into Kabul. Mm-hmm. So Taliban, the first few days when they, or first few months, as they say, when they show up, They fight all the corruption. People were happy with them, the Afghani themselves. They were very happy with Taliban. They kick everything a few days or for a few weeks. People of Afghani were very happy. Then when they reach to Kabul, all these fighters get to fight each other, and we know what happens till today. So that we have a model. We have a model that could happen, answer to your questions. We don't know the answer for the future. We have models. We have a model to say Israeli and the Arab countries and anti-Islamist countries, if we call it. They will say, you know what? That's good. Iranian was out of Syria. It's not good to reach to Damascus. Damascus is a different story. So let's stop them in Damascus. I did Damascus and the border, the area from Damascus to Israeli-Jordan borders to be buffer zone between the Islamists and the Israel. So let them enjoy what they have. Let's enjoy what we have and let's have the buffer zone. That means Assad will stay. The third part, that the people will be able to go into HTS, will be in Syria. They will take top of the regime. And the big question will be that what you ask, will the people accept them to be there? I mean, today, the people are happy of liberation from Iranian, from Assad, from all this disaster they did. There's no sympathy with most of the Syrian of what Assad did and the Iranian. But is that me that we accept them? Day after, do we accept the Syrian? Syrian, we have Kurds, we have Christian, we have Muslims. So it's not it's heterogeneous society. You cannot control it by strict Islamic people like this people. Usually, before the Assad family came, most of the Syrian they were ruling Syria. And now suddenly you get a person requested his head on the FBI wanted list to be the head of the country. I mean, it's heavy. Regardless what he say about himself, what people around him say about him, that he's changed, he's good, he's whatever. Syria is complicated. It's not easy part to rule by its people, by its geography. So I don't think Syrian people today in the mood to think day after. They are looking for how to get rid of Assad. But as I mentioned, we are phase one. We have a lot of unknown uncertainties the day after in Syria. Yeah. And here where I think, look, U.S., I have been in U.S. quite good time, 10, 11 years, working on Syria from D.C. Most of the people, they get lazy. They think, you know, this is complicated. It's not in our agenda. China, Taiwan, inflation, immigration, NATO, Ukraine. When you list the issues that United States has a priority, Syria does not exist. Middle East, without Israeli conflict, I think even the Middle East doesn't exist. But the whole war United States is doing is in the Middle East. So you cannot ignore the Middle East. You see that comes. I think today the United States should take the lead with the EU to put some kind of, will push pressure on Turkey to make things balanced before it become too late. To say, guys, let's make balance today. Let's make military council. Let's make kind of council that get everybody on board or Syrian on board in order to avoid all unneed consequences, unneed results. If these countries, they don't use that leverage, I think we are open to a lot of uncertainties. Could be good. Most probably it will be bad. We don't know that yet.
Yeah, I'm curious. So you mentioned on Twitter a few days ago that you had spoken with Rick Grenell, who will, yep, you know, is an advisor to incoming President Donald Trump, and will almost certainly play some role in his foreign policy team. I'm curious if he gave any insight as to how a Trump administration might approach the situation happening now in Syria.
This was a free preview of
Non-Zero World.
To unlock the rest of this conversation and other exclusive content, become an NZN member at nonzero.substack.com.